The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 176, A Generic Spiritual Creation by Kent C. Condi, with comments by Richard Sherlock.
I'm not scheduled to introduce Kent Condi, but I was instrumental in helping him get onto this program. And he and I were old college mates, used to talk about evolution at great length. So it's a pleasure to introduce Kent Condi, who is a professor at New Mexico Tech in Albuquerque, and he will discuss the item that's on your program, and the respondent will be Richard Southwick. Richard Sherlock. Kent was one of my best friends in college, and this is one of my best students at Bountiful High.
Okay. Thank you. It's been a long time.
Well, I can see we have a hardcore group here today. What I'd like to do is present a hypothesis today to test. Much in the way we use in science, we have hypotheses and we test them against factual data. Well, I'd like to present sort of a theological hypothesis dealing with the spiritual creation. LDS people, of course, we have a rather unique interpretation of the spiritual creation. And present it in the light that we'd like to have it tested against future data, not only factual data as it becomes available, but in scriptural data and the various ways that we might interpret scriptures, and see how the model holds up. And if it holds up, we can keep it in there as a model, as a working model. But just like in science, if the way we work in science, we really never prove anything's right. What we do is prove things are wrong, and we keep eliminating things. And indeed, if we find something that is powerful enough to eliminate this model, then we get rid of it and try something else. I guess we can start on the slides there. There's a couple of basic assumptions which are pretty widely accepted, I find, in the church that I'd like to operate with in pursuing this. One is that God operates by natural laws, and of course, I think this is widely accepted in the church. And he created the earth by natural laws. He populated it by natural laws. And he uses natural laws to do what he wants to do. And two deals with predestination. And predestination is generally considered not compatible with LDS scriptures. Spirits are not predestined to go into specific mortal organisms. Events are not predestined to happen. And indeed, there are many scriptures that verify this sort of relationship. Next slide, please. I think I will come out. Come back here. I can see the slides, too. Now, the spiritual creation is something that we all have heard about. We all have our own opinions about it. And there are several scriptures that allude to this, especially the LDS scriptures in the DNC and in the Pearl of Great Price. Here's one from Moses. Every plant in the field before it was on earth, every herb in the field before it grew, for I, the Lord, created all things we've spoken of spiritually, for they were created temporally. This is another white hell belief that sort of sets Mormon theology apart from many other religions. Next slide. Now, another idea that Joseph Smith was the first to suggest, and we see it in the Doctrine and Covenants, we see it in the Pearl of Great Price, is the idea of intelligences, that every living thing, certainly every human, presumably every living thing, was made by God from an intelligence. In other words, he used something that already existed. He didn't start out from nothing to make man, but he used intelligences which are thought to be co-eternal with God. Now, we don't know exactly how to describe intelligences. The information we have all of them is not very precise. If we look at the next slide, there's some early writers in the church which gave some pretty definitive information in terms of their opinion. For instance, B.H. Roberts, intelligence are uncreated entities, some inhabiting spiritual bodies, some not. They possess powers of comparison and discrimination. That's interesting, comparison and discrimination. They can discern between good and evil, between good and better. They possess will or freedom, in other words, free agency. They can think their own thoughts, act wisely or foolishly, do right or wrong. That's a lot of characteristics for intelligences. Presumably, those intelligences then carry those characteristics with them as they're placed in spirits and then eventually into mortal bodies. Next slide. Now, if we look just briefly and diagrammatically at a little diagram here I created on my Macintosh for the spiritual and the temporal creation, and we take an intelligence. I'm going to use a little white box that I can walk over here or not. In this and subsequent slides, just to illustrate the intelligence. Of course, we don't know the size of intelligences. We don't know virtually anything about them, but I'm going to use a little white box, okay? We're going to combine the intelligence with what I'm going to call a generic spirit, and that's the idea I want to actually propose to test here, is the concept of a generic spirit. I'll define that in just a minute. But we're going to combine the intelligence in a generic spirit, okay? And then this would be the spiritual creation, okay? And then we're going to take that generic spirit, which has an intelligence in it, see, I keep the little white box going, with a mortal body, here I show a fetus or an embryo, to give us a nice return missionary over here, okay? Okay, so we have the two types of creations. We'll go to the next slide now. Now, the way I'd like to define a generic spirit is as follows, and this is what we need to think about, I think, in testing this model. Generic spirit is a spirit that's not predestined for a specific organism. That's probably the key issue here in the generic spirit. It's not predestined to go in any mortal organism here on Earth. Depending on its complexity, it can enter one of many different life forms. And I'll come back to that in a few minutes. In other words, a generic spirit that goes into a human life form would not be the same generic spirit that, say, goes into a dog or into some plant or into a unicellular life form. Only when a generic spirit is placed in an organism does it become a specific spirit. Okay, so this is the difference. Once the spirit is placed in an organism here on Earth, an immortal organism, be it plant or animal, it then becomes very specific to that organism. But prior to being placed in that mortal spirit, it's generic. Okay, this is definitional now. Okay, you'll just allow me these definitions for a minute, and then we're going to pursue this idea as we test this model. Yeah, next slide. Well, let's take a look at it here in terms of the spiritual creation, the temporal creation. Here we have our intelligence with some of the characteristics that B.H. Roberts suggests up there. Self-consciousness, choice, ability to compare, something that's existed in intelligences ad infinitum, shall we say. So this intelligence is a unique entity in itself, okay? It's a unique entity in itself. When God made the spiritual or created things spiritually, he put intelligences into spirits. Now, I'm going to show spirits on here. We don't know what spirits look like either. Maybe some of you think we do. Maybe we know something about them. But to avoid that issue, which I don't want to get into, I'm going to show spirits as blobs, okay, with irregular shapes. The more complex the irregular shape, the more complex the spirit. That doesn't mean that the shape is more complex, but it says something about the personality and the mentality of the spirit in its terms of its complexity. Okay? I'm not to this yet, just this part. Okay. Yes. Yes. One for one. The temporal creation now, God takes the generic spirit and puts it, I'm just going to talk about humans, incidentally, from this point on, but the same thing, I think, really we have to think of in terms of other life forms. But I'll just restrict it to humans. During the temporal creation, God takes the generic spirit, but that generic spirit, as I say, is not predestined for a given individual. It can go in, and I've tried to show a whole bunch of people here, it can go into any one of those.
It's not predestined for any one of them.
Well, you say it could perhaps go into a grain of wheat?
No.
Or a frog?
No. A frog will have a whole other group of generic spirits there.
That would be frog generic spirits.
Here we're just talking about human generic spirits. Okay, next slide. And what about the size and shape of spirits? We don't know anything about this to speak of either. Here's our intelligence. And I've taken an intelligence. I mean, one possibility is that the generic spirit has somewhat the shape of the organism it's going to go into, or maybe it doesn't. Maybe the generic spirit is very, very small, and indeed if the generic spirit enters the embryo at the time of conception, which some people believe, then it has to be indeed very, very small, I think. Or here's another picture over here of it going into a blobby sort of generic spirit, which takes on some other shape. But we don't know much about the shape and size of spirits in general. Next slide. So what do we know about the spiritual creation? The spiritual creation occurred before the temporal creation, so we have a timing there. I think we have to be careful here because the spiritual creation may still be going on. We know some of it occurred before the temporal creation. Number two, temporal creation is patterned at least some degree after the spiritual creation. We're told that in scriptures, in Abraham, and in Moses in particular, that there's a pattern. I want to say a little more about that in a minute. Number three, all living things were created spiritually before they were created temporally. How much before? 10 minutes? 1 million years? 1 billion years? Maybe the answer is all of the above. Again, that's something we don't know a lot about. Next slide. Now, from Joseph Smith's time on, the spiritual creation has been thought of by many people in the church as a blueprint for the temporal creation. If we think of a blueprint like an architect performs or draws a blueprint, I'd like to think of this in two ways here. In other words, what I want to do is I'd like to preserve the idea of no predestination. I don't find predestination very appealing in terms of my philosophy of LDS theology. And I think a lot of people feel this way. So I've got two sort of variants here, okay? The number one variant, here's the spiritual creation, by the way. Here's the temporal creation. One of them requires predestination. One of them doesn't. Allows free agency in here. You'll notice the little boxes I've got in there. They're in exactly the same position over here. That blueprint is a one-to-one, allows no variation. This predestines every single organism to two specific parents on this earth. It predestines events to occur which can lead up to those things. That's the exact replica. Another possible model, however, is the one that allows a bit of change. I think, to use the analogy again, which may or may not be good with an architect's drawing. Very often the architect decides after he's drawing and they start constructing that some changes have to be made that he didn't foresee initially or that would make things better. This is the idea here that I would like to suggest. To me, it's easier to buy than the one that has predestination built into it. This allows for free agency. Next slide. Now, during the spiritual creation, intelligence were placed into generic spirits which continued to progress. Now, the intelligences were progressing in this pre-existence referring now to the time before the spiritual creation. They were progressing then. Well, they continued to progress. When God placed them in generic spirits, that didn't stop that. Maybe it limited it. Maybe it opened up in a large number of ways that they could progress that they could not progress as intelligences. Again, we don't know.
Why did you say that they could progress in the intelligent state? What was the thought behind that?
The thought behind that is there's a couple of scriptures that I can't quote them to you right now that allude to that. And it's appealing to think that they can progress in that stage. But it's not critical to the generic spirit model. It's not critical to that. Yeah. Well, there's a couple of scriptures that can be interpreted that way. Next slide. Now, if we look at the pre-existence, we don't know an awful lot about that either. But you might say, does the generic spirit model, can it fit our concepts of the pre-existence? Okay, so if we believe there was a great war in heaven and a great meeting and we had all the generic spirits here, and after the war, roughly two-thirds of them followed Christ, who gave the model of free agency, and one-third of them followed Satan. These, of course, came to take on bodies. These could continue to excel in various ways. These we don't know much about. But this is adaptable to the generic spirit model. Any one of these generic spirits could have gone this way had they chose to do so, or they could have gone this way with Christ had they chose to do so. So the element of choice is still there with the generic spirit model. The element of choice is still there. Next slide. I don't want to talk about immortality, but it's one thing that we have to think about, I think, in terms of the generic spirit model. And the question is it compatible with the generic spirit model? Well, here's our mortal individual. That little square in there should be the... I guess this one I forgot to put the intelligences in there. So you can use your imagination that there's an intelligence in there. At death, of course, the spirit, which is now not a generic spirit anymore, it's a specific spirit of this individual. It's not a generic spirit anymore. It's a specific spirit of that individual. We separate the spirit and the body at death. And then, during the resurrection, we recombine them. We're not sure just how this happens. The popular idea is, of course, is a literal resurrection of the mortal body in a combination with this SS, which is the specific spirit, to give us an immortal body. The reason I got that question mark there is because I think there might be other possibilities here. Certainly the mortal body we have today can't exactly be the one. There's got to be some differences for it to be an immortal body. But I don't want it. That's an aside issue. It isn't important for the generic spirit model. Right. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. It's a good question. The important thing is here, from this point on, from death on, we're dealing with a specific spirit of this individual. It's not a generic spirit anymore. Next slide. Let's look at a couple of other concepts. What I'm trying to do now is test this generic spirit model against a few other things. Now, foreordination is something that is certainly a belief of the LDS Church. And this is one scripture that was received by Joseph F. Smith when he was a president of the church, which indeed suggests foreordination. Were chosen in the beginning rulers of the Church of God even before they were born, and so on. Okay? And there are several other scriptures, I'm sure some of you are more familiar with them than I am, that allude to or are very specific in terms of individuals being called for certain responsibilities during this lifetime. What I want to do now is just see, does the generic spirit model allow us foreordination or doesn't it? Next. Foreordination is the doctrine that certain spirits were called pre-existence to perform specific tasks as mortals. Predestination issue is sidestepped with the caveat that a foreordained spirit can choose as a mortal whether to carry out that calling or not. And we commonly hear that if Joseph Smith didn't carry out presumably his foreordained calling, somebody else would have. So that gets us around the predestination issue with foreordination, doesn't it? Because we've got that element of choice still in there. Next slide. Okay, what about the generic spirit in terms of foreign nation? Here we have a generic spirit with an intelligence in it, the little white box. Now, in this case, let's suppose that this generic spirit was foreordained for something. We are constrained then a little bit, perhaps, as to what sort of individual this can go to in this life, by time or location or maybe some other things, and maybe sex. I haven't put that in here. Gender is something else we really don't know about. A really important question is, do these intelligences have gender or not, you see? And I certainly don't know the answer to that. Anyway, that's a side issue, I think.
At what point does a
generic spirit become a specific spirit? When it enters the embryo, in the case of an animal. When it enters the seed, in the case of a plant, or an angiosperm. I don't know. I'm not going to go that far. Well, if I implied that, I didn't really mean to imply that. I'd rather leave that question open. Yeah, it may not be sex in the sense we think of sex. It's the ability to reproduce. Whether they had that or not, we don't know. Perhaps. I don't want to get on that issue, but that is certainly a perhaps. Let me just continue. Actually, I was right in the middle of this when the questions came up. So here we have our generic spirit. Now, it could go into any one of a number of individuals here. Perhaps gender would be important for a given calling. Perhaps for another calling, gender would not be important. But certainly, when this person or this spirit came into this mortal being, time might be important. For instance, if George Washington's spirit was foreordained, as some believe, he had to come at a certain time, didn't he? Joseph Smith certainly had to come at a certain time if he's foreordained. Location might be important. If Joseph Smith was born as a black African in Central Africa, he may not have found the golden plates there. So, I mean, there are certain other variables that have to come in here that might constrain where a given generic spirit comes into a given individual. Okay, but that story doesn't destroy the generic spirit model, I don't know. Next slide. Something else now. God's foreknowledge. This is something that I've often wrestled with, and obviously many church leaders have wrestled with this. I have two quotations here, one from B.H. Roberts and one from James Talmage. If God's foreknowledge is absolute, I think we run into a problem with predestination. That means regardless of what we do, something's going to happen in the future, and we're going to act in a certain way, we're going to do a certain thing, if his foreknowledge is absolute. Well, if you look at James Talmage, this is a couple of opinions. God's foreknowledge is based on intelligence and reason. He foresees a future as a state which naturally and surely will be, but not as one, and I've capitalized this, must be. Because he arbitrarily will be that way. And then B.H. Roberts, God knows all that is known, which includes all that has been, but that the future is not known. I've capitalized the two words not known by God in an absolute sense until it happens. And you may not buy that, but let me pursue this line just a little bit. Next slide. I don't think so. I think they say the same thing in a slightly different way.
God's foreknowledge will be, even though it doesn't happen. knows everything that will happen in the future. And B.H. Roberts is saying that foreknowledge cannot be certain.
I think this goes farther. I think this is a tame statement. This is a wild statement. Okay. That's right. Exactly right. Exactly right. Next slide. Okay, let's look at the timeline. In geology, we have an arrow of time. Okay. And I've got the arrow of time here, past, present, and future, with time going to the right. Here's God up here. This, if you take, for instance, B.H. Roberts' idea here that his absolute foreknowledge, his absolute knowledge, applies to the past and the present. But I've dashed this line out here in the future. Is his foreknowledge absolute out here? Or is it a high probability prediction out here? If it's absolute out there, I think we run into predestination problems again. But of course, God is a pretty good predictor, much better than our best supercomputer, isn't he? Much, much better. So he can predict with a high degree of precision. But that still leaves us a way out to preserve non-predestination, I think. Next slide. That being the case, for instance, here are three generic spirits up here. Okay, here's our timeline. Those three generic spirits could go in any place here, presuming they're not foreordained and they have to go someplace in particular. For instance, that one goes into the future, this one goes in the past, and this one here. Or you could shift those lines around, for instance. It doesn't predestine those generic spirits for any particular period of time. I don't know. I don't know how much choice. That's another very interesting question. Maybe the God allows some choice up there in presenting there. We don't know, but that's a very interesting question, I think. Certainly it would allow that. Next slide. Okay, now, one other thing that when I got thinking about this a few years ago, can be a big stumbling block is Christ and his premortal appearances here on the earth. There are quite a few scriptures, and I've just listed 10 or so of them up here. There are more than that. We're in the concordance. Premortal appearances of Christ. In some instances, it was just his voice. In some instances, it was a finger or something. And in other instances, he appeared in his whole body. The classic one, of course, is in ether. The next slide gives that scripture from Ether, where the brother of Jared, behold, this is my body, which you now behold, the body of my spirit. Okay? And man have I created after the body of my spirit. That strongly suggests then that what? Christ's spirit looked like his temporal body, doesn't it? I mean, that's pretty strongly implied there. And if that's the case, where does this leave us with generic spirits? We throw the whole thing out. Well, indeed, we have a problem. Next slide. Seems to me there's a couple of possibilities to consider. Maybe some of you can think of some others. There's two that I thought of here. One is that Christ was different from everybody else and that he really was predestined for a specific, for a spirit. He was predestined for a given spirit. Second, it was not Christ that made those appearances, Jehovah in the Old Testament and such. Somebody else. I don't like the second one because that requires deceit on the part of God. Even though the result was the same, it still requires deceit, doesn't it? What about the first one? That Christ really was predestined for a given spiritual body. Maybe it's not too much to ask or to think of this being unique. Christ is unique in so many ways from us, isn't he? A heavenly Father and a mortal mother, the atonement. I mean, there's so many ways he's unique. I won't have any problem adding another thing to that list. Next slide. In fact, this is a scripture in Romans that strongly suggests predestination for whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son. They even use the word predestinate in that scripture in Romans. Next slide. Okay, what I want to do now is get away from the scriptures a little bit, and I want to test the generic spirit model a little bit into some terms of some contemporary issues today. And I just want to look at three of these issues. There are many more that could be looked at. One is cloning and generic engineering. The other is abortion. And the other is organic evolution. Let's start out with cloning. Incidentally, I'm not a biologist. If any of you are biologists, you might be able to expound on this. But clearly when Dolly the sheep was cloned here a few years ago, it was a big stir. And incidentally, I don't want to dwell on the ethical issues of cloning. I think that's a whole other issue. All I want to do now is test the idea of generic spirits against cloning. Now, in cloning, what one does, this is sort of a generalized flow sheet for cloning. There are perturbations that can be different. For instance, the cells are taken from one organism and they're grown in a culture, okay? And then the egg is taken from another organism, the chromosomes are taken out, the cells are placed in that egg, and then you have to activate the whole scene. In the case of Dolly, they activate it with an electrical shock. There's chemicals, apparently, they can do that too with. Anyway, that gets it going, and then they place that egg in a surrogate mother, which gives rise then to a clone of the individual that this came from. Now, we haven't... I'm sorry. It may not be the first word I misspelled on there. Although, to my knowledge, a human has not been cloned yet. This is, of course, a very controversial issue. From what we know in biology right now, we're either at or very, very close to the point that a human can be cloned. And some of my geneticist friends assure me that somebody will probably do it in the next few years, legally, illegally, morally, immorally, but it's probably going to be done. What does this mean, the fact that we can clone individuals? And attached to the same problem or issue is the whole question of generic engineering. When geneticists go in to the embryo and start modifying it, changing it, what does this, one, the spiritual creation, what does it say about the generic spirit model? Next slide. Well, one way of looking at it is here we have, let's suppose, three clones, okay, that are produced by genetic engineering. Well, you might, one way of thinking about it is God picks three generic spirits which are almost alike. I mean, he has an awful lot of generic spirits up there. So if he picks three of those generic spirits that are almost alike to go in those three clones to give us three sister missionaries here that are almost alike, it preserves the generic spirit model, I think. Now, the whole issue of whether geneticists should be playing around with genes is another issue. Next slide. When we modify genes to improve the human race, are we playing God? Some people would say we are, some people would say we aren't. And again, that's not really what I want to defend one way or the other. But I want to ask this question. Is it not equally plausible that God is using geneticists to help improve the human race? Is it possible that God makes use of scientists to do things that he wants to do? That is very appealing to me. I'm not saying he does it, but I'm just asking that question. Isn't it possible that God is using geneticists to do things like that? Let me quote you, next slide, out of a recent book on cloning by John Harris. This is a quotation from that book in which he has a chapter in there on whether geneticists are playing God when they do that. More of the idea that human beings should not disturb what God has so carefully arranged presupposes, I've capitalized the word presupposes, that we and the disturbing things we do are not part of those arrangements. Next slide. Now, I just want to say a little bit about abortion, which is another very, very controversial issue, isn't it? Of course, in the church, a very strong stand is taken against abortion. This is a paraphrase from one of President Hinckley's recent talks on abortion, except for a few instances which are listed up there at the top. The church takes a very strong stand against abortion at any stage of fetal development. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? Next slide. Now, in terms of the generic spirit model, one of the questions I think that is extremely important, which to my knowledge we don't know the answer to, and that's when the spirit enters the embryo or the fetus, as the case may be. Here we have conception. We have the development, the ontology, up to some stage here, embryonic development. Well, someplace in here, the spirit enters this. Maybe it's right up here at conception. Some people believe that. Perhaps it's at birth. I don't think many people in the church at least believe that it's at birth. Perhaps it's somewhere in between, okay, between conception and birth. Well, why is that important? Next slide. I think it's important because, as it indicates down here, if the generic spirit is placed in the embryo or the fetus, as the case may be, and the abortion is prior to the time the generic spirit goes in there, well, then that generic spirit will simply be placed in another embryo someplace else. It will not prevent that generic spirit from coming to this life and taking on a body. I'll say that once more. If the generic spirit enters enters the embryo or the fetus after sometime late over here, and then the abortion is performed, then it kills that generic spirit, and that person is prevented from taking on a body during this life. So, that's right. If the generic spirit's in there, of course, it then goes on to the spirit world, doesn't it, without taking on a body.
Why couldn't it just be a slave to another body?
Sorry?
I mean, if it's generic, what difference does it make to the body if it's assigned to it? If it's aborted, then that one could be reassigned to a different body.
Yeah, that's fine. And that's what I'm suggesting here. If the abortion is performed prior to the time that the spirit enters this individual, once the spirit is in that individual, it's no longer a generic spirit. Remember from my onset, it's then a specific spirit. Once
Well, it does. It's
critical whether it dies. You say it dies, it goes to the spirit world, doesn't it? Yeah. But if the abortion is performed before that spirit is put into that embryo, then we're not preventing that spirit from being placed in another embryo. Well, I think it does. I think it's a very, very important distinction. I think it's a very important distinction, yeah.
You've opened Pandora's box. The majority of all spirits, according to your theory, would then never achieve a body because there are many more spontaneously aborted fetuses that come into the world than there are fetuses that are held to full term. You have to check.
That's true. No, I have read that. It's something like 30 or 40% of... Yeah.
In many cases, the women never know that they have...
That's right. But that would be before the spirit entered the body, perhaps. Then it wouldn't make any difference, you see.
But it happens all the way through. I mean, it's not.
Yeah.
It isn't that one stage is opposed to another. So what you're really saying is that most of the spirits that come into the world don't make it.
No, I don't know enough about what the distribution is in terms of when these spontaneous abortions occur. One article I read on this indicated that most of them were very early in the first few weeks, which would be possible that that's before the spirit ever entered the body. Well, that would be the next step to argue here, wouldn't it? In other words, if this model were correct, it would suggest then that the spirit came in, and let me just develop this a little bit more. Clearly, the embryo can be played around with by geneticists, not only in terms of cloning, but in genetic engineering, for quite a while. I'm not sure what the time element is on that. Clearly, embryos have been fused, okay? And if the embryos are fused early on, does that mean the spirits are fused? Does that mean we have individuals today that have multiple spirit parents? That's a little hard, mind-boggling for me to conceive of that. And so I would like to think that there's some period of time that where geneticists can play around with the embryos, okay, and change things, either cloning, genetic engineering, or whatever. And that sometime after that is where the spirit enters. Otherwise, we're going to get in a real problem as to whether we divide spirits, do we combine spirits, what are we going to do with these spirits?
Sorry? The other problem that genealogists in the church say, official policy is you don't do any, you don't even put them on the record of the church if they die before their life of childbirth. Even if they're being born and they don't really make it to life, but there is no record of it.
Mm-hmm.
So the church is officially stating they aren't
mm-hmm.
people yet. So then we have the problem really, which is it?
Mm-hmm.
Because if eternal life is dependent upon those ordinances being performed, we're saying they don't even exist, don't even keep a record of the ordinances. What's the story?
Yeah. That may be a temporary church policy, too, that could change in the future. But for okay. I wasn't aware that questions were going to come up as we went on. I thought they'd be at the end. This is fine. I like this, but it's going to take a little longer. I do want to talk about organic evolution in this model a little bit, which is the last thing, so maybe we better move on to that. Well, I'm saying it's a very difficult problem, and I would like to think of it that the spirits come in after a time. God places spirits in this fetus after a time that geneticists can change things. Now, I don't know when that time is.
If that change is a change to the body, doesn't mean it's also a change to the spirit.
Well, suppose you fuse an embryo, two embryos together, and the spirit is in both of them. What happens? Same question, yeah, whether you split it or combine it. What happens to the spirit? Yeah. That's because that's a mind-boggling question that...
that body appears at birth without an arm. Is the spirit also without an arm?
I don't know.
Let's go on.
Yes.
We never going to answer these questions. You're raising great issues.
Yes. Okay. I just want to pursue one more thing. And that's to look at the generic spirit model in terms of organic evolution. First of all, perhaps I find a great number of people in the church don't know that the church does not take an official stand on organic evolution as the means by which man was created. And I have a couple of letters from past church presidents, and I have a recent letter that I've written to Boyd K. Packard, and he verifies that indeed the same policy exists in the church today as did when David O. McKay wrote the first letter, or one of the first letters on this issue. Anyway, if you allow me just for a minute to accept the organic evolution model, and I realize that that is extremely controversial, and especially with the creationism people in the U.S. today, which are pushing the other attributes, But if you allow me to accept that for just a minute, and indeed, organic evolution is not a theory in terms of generic engineering. We do that all the time. The part of it that's a theory is that the Earth was populated by organic evolution, and in particular, man is one of the end products of this series. That means billion years ago, and MA means million years ago. Okay? Those are geological symbols. Billion years ago is GA, MA is million years ago. So if you allow me to accept organic evolution as the means by which mutation in genes is a natural law, natural selection is a natural law, and those are the two basic premises of organic evolution. I don't see any problem with God using those two natural laws to populate the earth. For instance, this is some of the evolutionary benchmarks we have. It appears like life formed on Earth about 4 billion years ago. We can constrain that now in a couple of ways. The oldest fossils we have are about 3.5 billion years ago. These are bacteria, fossil bacteria. Before 4 billion years ago, the Earth was being bombarded by tremendous asteroid-sized bodies which would have killed off any life. So we can constrain it to approximately 4 billion years. Some of the events here, you'll notice up at the top, how rapidly things happened up here, the appearance of land, plants, and mammals. And finally, man, and of course, it depends on how you define man. I don't really want to get into this, although we may be led into that. If we look at Homo sapiens appeared on Earth about 2 million years ago. Australopithecus, which is probably ancestral to Homo sapiens, appeared 3.5 or 4 million years ago. Okay, next slide. Now, how does this fit, or can it fit, with the generic spirit model? Well, one idea that I've been playing around with is that God has a tremendous number of generic spirits of all complexities, and that he is operated by genetics and natural selection to populate our earth. And I've just indicated some of the organisms over here. And I've indicated over here diagrammatic. This is not meant to represent shapes. But the more complicated the shape is on there, the more complicated the generic spirit. And he has an array of generic spirits that he's created. And he places these in the appropriate organisms as they appear on Earth in the geologic record. Okay? With the human spirit, of course, being the singly most complicated, patterned directly after God himself. I think this is an idea that is at least worth pursuing. And it certainly preserves the generic spirit model. Next slide. In terms of man, if we look at the evolution of hominins now, here's the primitive hominids, Australopithecus, okay, which appeared 3.5 million years ago. Excellent record now. It's appearing in East Africa. So-called missing links are being found so fast that almost every issue or every other issue of the scientific magazine Nature has a new find in East Africa. Appears like East Africa is where man started out. Australopithecus, anyway. We go up to Homo erectus, also in East Africa, and finally Homo sapiens here. I just illustrated some skulls here. Now, within the hominids, I think God has created, or could have created, a lot of generic spirits, hominid generic spirits, of varying degrees of complexity. Australopithecus has a very simple generic spirit, but still it's a hominid generic spirit. And up at the top up there are the most advanced of the hominid generic spirits that God reserved to put in man. Next slide. And Adam, yes. That's a very important question. Yes. Can I just finish up here? If you're interested, I can. That's something I enjoy talking about a lot. We, of course, don't know the answer to that, but I think we can speculate a little bit. What if humans continue to evolve in the future? There's no reason they shouldn't. It'd be a little different now, though, because we have control over how they evolve through generic engineering. but they may still continue to evolve and become more complicated. Is there any reason to think that God may not have in reserve up there some more complicated human spirits waiting for appropriate mortal places to reside? I don't know. Next slide. Well, I've got three slides with conclusions on here now. You can just read those. Predestination can be avoided. A generic spirit is placed in a mortal body. It then becomes a specific spirit. Spiritual creation was probably an outline rather than an exact replica to preserve or to get not involve predestination. Intelligence, generic spirits can be progress and they can be foreordained. Next slide. God's absolute foreknowledge applies to present and the past, but probably not the future in an absolute sense. Genesis may play an important role in designing and improving mortal bodies, which God places generic spirits. Abortion is performed prior to the time the spirit enters the embryo or fetus. The spirit enters another fetus. Thus, it is not prevented from acquiring a mortal body. Next slide. Life evolved on Earth over 4 billion years. Increasingly complex generic spirits appeared to enter these bodies. No spirit was predestined for a specific mortal organism, but spirits of a given degree of complexity went into given mortal organisms as they appeared in the geologic record. Most complex generic spirits were reserved for humans, patterned after God's own image. I think I'll stop there. I don't know if we have time to pursue. There's a lot of other... Oh, sorry, yes.
We can just keep the discussion going.
Do you want this?
Yeah, put it up. I don't know, maybe... I can speak loud enough. Yeah, but they want it on tape, don't they? All right, so I should get up here so you can all see me. They want the tape, so we'll give them a tape. I'll try and make my comments brief, and hopefully I've eliminated some of what I thought of suggesting, because we haven't really covered those points that were in the text in the discussion so far. So I'm kind of going to skip over a couple of things. First, let me say I agree with Dr. Condi on many points on divine foreknowledge. I think you can re-understand the notion of divine omniscience, but it isn't the same old divine omniscience that you would get in kind of theism in Christian theism, Christian, Muslim, or Jewish theism, generally, it's a different concept. But I think you can do that. I agree on it, in general, on evolution. I think the term generic spirits is very likely to be misleading. A generic drug, for example, is equivalent to a brand name. There are only four companies in the world that manufacture aspirin. But you can buy 100 different brands of aspirin. You can buy the Rite Aid aspirin. You can buy Smith's aspirin. And they're all equivalent. The only one that really markets it under its own name is Bayer. And that's the company that 125 years ago discovered aspirin. But I would suggest that, according to Mormon doctrine, I am not equivalent to any other spirit, and that has been true from eternity forward. So I would suggest the term generic spirit suggests something that isn't true, or that isn't correct, that buys more trouble than it's worth, if you will. I find the notion of genetic improvement to be very problematic as well, because I'm not sure that we know what improvement means. I'm not sure that we know what the eternal standard is against which any improvement is to be measured. I think for example, the hardest single case of abortion to justify, of all the cases that are widely discussed in the American public, is the case of prenatal diagnosis and selective abortion. Because no one goes through a test up until very recently, amniocentesis, either later in pregnancy or earlier, but earlier was pretty far along. No one goes through a test like that, or the newer forms of test, colonic villi sampling, those tests, if they really didn't want to be pregnant, if they wanted to exercise a choice, legal, moral, whatever you want to call it, if they wanted to exercise a choice not to be pregnant right now, you go through those tests under the assumption, I wanted to be pregnant, and I will continue to have the baby, except I don't want a damaged one. And that seems to me to be a very difficult principle to justify. Now, let me, because it gets me to a point, it gets me to some points that I want to make. Let me use the question of abortion, not to talk about the question of abortion, but to talk about a larger topic. I'm not sure that the morality of abortion can be determined by an answer we don't know, namely, when does the spirit enter the body? Why? But in order to get at the morality of abortion, we might want to look at it this way. We want to, in a larger moral context, why is it wrong for me, right now, to pull out a gun and kill Dr. Condi? Why is that wrong? To say that killing is scripturally condemned is to beg the question. That's to say it's wrong because it's wrong. Now, it cannot be because of what Dr. Condi has done in the past, either for himself or others. The past is over and done with. No, it must be because of, if we all accept the proposition it's wrong for me to do that, there are two grounds on which that might be argued. The first is that what is done, that it's wrong because of what is done to Dr. Condi, or two, what is done to me in the act. Now take the first view. The only reason that it would be wrong for me to kill Dr. Condi on behalf, in the case of what's done to Dr. Condi, is because of what Dr. Condi will do in the future, namely, have happiness for himself and bring happiness to others. But that argument, that claim that what is wrong is because of future happiness, applies from the moment of conception on, if you think it through. Or we could say that it's wrong because of me, what I become. That is, I exercise dominion over life and death, over the course of events. I exercise a kind of dominion that is maybe demonic. Now, it has to be either one. I would suggest that it has to be either one of those alternatives. Now, what leads me to think that the second, that is, the character that I exercise in the act, may be more decisive? Well, and here I want to go to the heart of a question that came up in our discussion and in the text. If I was from eternity without a physical body, and it was I, and if I will be a physical body, I will be me after I am dead without a physical body. And I will be until the new body is created. If I will be the same person through time without a physical body, then my physical body cannot be me. There's an elementary reason for this, an elementary point, just a thought I would offer. My resurrected body is not mine, is not this body. Alma and Paul say it's a spiritual body. This body will decay. If I am to exist while this body is decaying, and before I get a spiritual body, then I cannot be my body. So that suggests to me at least the question of whether or not the purpose of mortality is to gain a physical body. Because I will exist without it. I'm not sure. It seems to me there are two ways in which you can think of what mortality is all about. Getting a physical body, which I suggest this whole metaphysics of personhood through time at least calls into question. Or mortality is a process of moral and spiritual growth. And if that's the key, then the question of when the spirit enters the body becomes secondary to the question of moral growth. And if the question of moral growth is key to mortality, then you come back to what I think is the practical input of Mormonism on questions like abortion. If you really look at the cases in which the church approves of abortion, there's exception clauses big enough to drive a truck through. There really are. It doesn't approve of all cases. But if you ask around, when women have had to go through this difficult question, they've asked their bishops, and they've asked their stake presidents, they've asked their area authorities, and they've consulted with area presidencies, the actual cases are big enough to drive a truck through. A lawyer would tell you that the exceptions evacuate the rule. But there's a point to the whole business in that what we're looking at is the character of the people in the process. And that suggests to me that the key to mortality is spiritual growth. The problem with cloning is the question of whether or not we are morally wise enough to do these kinds of things. Not a metaphysics. So I just leave us with the question of whether or not the real purpose of mortality is moral growth. And if so, then I suggest that I will be me through time. But it is what I become that is important. Thank you.